Hello world, welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. Joining me this evening is Joe King on remote. We can also be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the internet and on WBAI 99.5 FM radio in New York and WBAI.org live streaming on the internet at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. The following show has been pre-recorded. We have been asked if we plan to do any more live shows. It all depends on the schedule and availability of studio equipment and space. We may work out a hybrid or a variation of it. This year, as we end 2016, there have been two major technology issues that have been pushed up to the forefront of politics. The first is, where are the technology jobs? This past year, only 51% of STEM graduates were able to find work related to their field of study. STEM is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Yet, we're told we do not have enough students in the STEM field. A technology summit was held recently between President-elect Trump and leaders from the major tech corporations. Before the start of the meeting, IBM stepped up to the plate. President-elect Trump made employment issues a key campaign element. He met with leaders of the technology industry in New York recently, assuring them that he would make it easier for them to make trade deals. Among the topics discussed, according to several corporate executives and a transition official briefed on the meeting who asked for anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly, were vocational education and the need for more of it. The promise and peril of trade with China and immigration. The president-elect also asked the executives to see if they could not apply data analysis technology to detect and help rid of government waste. In the wake of Mr. Trump's victory, Forrester Research is cutting back its growth estimate for the United States tech market in 2017 to 4.3% from 5.1%. One reason is simple, it's caution. As large multinational manufacturers navigate a new and unpredictable administration, another reason is less tech spending by the government. As for 2018, there are so many ways things could happen that a forecast is impossible. It's all up for grabs. CEO Rometty is on Trump's advisory panel of business leaders. Before the announcement of a technology summit meeting, she had announced IBM plans to hire 25,000 people in the United States. IBM Chief Executive Ginni Rometty said she plans to hire about 25,000 people in the United States and invest $1 billion over the next 4 years, laying out her vision for filling technology jobs in America on the eve of meeting of industry leaders with President-elect Donald Trump. During the run-up to the election, Trump made employment issues a mainstay of his campaign, promising to scrap trade deals he viewed as draining jobs from the country and impose tariffs on imports if necessary. He has since claimed credit for preventing thousands of manufacturing jobs from moving overseas and used state incentives to strike a deal with Carrier, a unit of United Technologies Corporation, to pull back on its plan to move some operations to Mexico. Rometty is continuing what is emerging as a formula among technology companies. She pledges to create jobs and invest billions of dollars in the United States, even if the plans had already been in the works since before he was elected. The advantage for companies is that it can deflect criticism from the new administration that the industry is shifting jobs ashore while also giving Trump a way to take credit for job creation goals that may have little to do with his election. IBM said in March it had more than 25,000 positions open globally and that it had started to cut some jobs in the United States as part of a workforce rebalancing in an effort to add staff with cloud and other specified skills. Over the past few years, IBM has been criticized for eliminating thousands of jobs in the country and moving resources to places such as India. IBM said it hired more U.S. employees last year than it had in the past 5 years. Rometty said many technology jobs don't require an advanced degree, and she encouraged government investment in vocational education and training. We are hiring because the nature of work is evolving. That is also why many of the jobs are hard to fill, she says. What matters most is that these employees, with jobs such as cloud computing technicians and services delivery specialists, have relevant skills, often obtained through vocational training. IBM has been working on hiring for and preparing its employees in skills required to adapt to the newer areas of its business, such as cloud computing, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence. For example, about a third of its workforce will have learned by the end of this year design thinking, a problem-solving method, and favored by many tech startups. The dynamics of the global labor market have been changing, and there are large numbers of unfulfilled tech-related jobs in the United States, Rometty said. The disconnect comes from the lack of people with the requisite skills, she said. As industries from manufacturing to agriculture are reshaped by data science and cloud computing, jobs are being created that demand new skills, which in turn requires new approaches to education, training, and recruiting. Rometty called for an update to the Perkins Career and Technical Education Act, which provides federal funding to vocation and technical programs. She also highlighted an educational model that IBM helped design of a six-year public high school, which combines traditional coursework, community college classes, and internships focused on preparing students for technical jobs. IBM will work with states to open at least 20 more of these schools in the next year. The other major technology issue that has been controversial is cybersecurity, and last week we featured Fred Kaplan, who gave a very detailed chronology of the involvement of the United States in this area. This week we are highlighting a discussion with Electronic Frontier Foundation on the conflict between the FBI, who wants essentially a backdoor to every device and program, and its conflict with Apple Corporation, who drew a line on which it will not cross.
Shahid Buttar, who is a constitutional lawyer and in charge of outreach for the EFF, which is the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He's based in California, but he's really a universal person. If he's not wandering all over the country to solve problems with community outreach, he's doing hip-hop concerts. Seriously, we do are faced with a problem right now. And you are the lead of, I think it's, what is it, some 64 different technology companies
who represented them, yeah. EFF wrote an amicus brief to inform the magistrate judge in San Bernardino, and we were representing 40 different technologists from around the country.
And you, as such, you have submitted briefs to the federal court. And could you just very quickly summarize for those few people who don't quite understand, what is the problem with the FBI subpoenaing or suing the Apple organization?
Yeah, so what's happened here, it's no one's really suing anyone, but the FBI has gone to a federal court demanding an order, a judicial order, that would force Apple to write new code to undermine the device encryption on the iPhone platform. What makes it dangerous is that, and we should be clear here, this is according to the device's manufacturer, so there's no more expert voice with respect to this question. It is not possible to re-engineer a single phone. And people forget the reason why. Because the security protocols are built in at the operating system layer, Apple has to engineer a new operating system in order to effectuate the court order that the FBI is demanding. Doing that, creating new code, will require more than a single computer, which means that code has to be networked. Once it's on a server anywhere, it could conceivably be stolen.
And Apple knows that. Let me ask one question that I haven't seen addressed any place, and maybe it's just my fault that I haven't seen it addressed. Why could not the FBI give that phone to Apple and say, please dump the contents and send them back to us on paper?
It would create the same problem. Hacking the operating system, it's not about giving the FBI the code, it's about making the code.
No, I'm Once not the talking code is about the code, created, I'm talking about Apple bypassing the code to get the contents, not giving anybody the code that they use to get the contents, just to bypass the code, bypass the security, and dump the contents.
Yeah, I'm glad we're having this conversation because maybe it will relieve some of the similar misimpressions by our listeners. You can't get to the content on the phone without writing new code to displace the existing operating system.
Right.
And so in order to write the new code to displace the operating system, whether the phone is held by the FBI or Apple, for this makes no difference. Even if Apple has the phone, they can't crack the phone unless they write a new OS.
And once
writing a new operating system,
and once they've
written the security
patches, then they have violated the security, and they can't be sure that somebody else doesn't use that same new code on other phones.
It's not quite that simple. I mean, maybe just let me finish, and I'll explain it. So in order to bypass the security protocols, as the FBI is demanding, Apple has to write a new operating system. Writing a new operating system can't be done on a single machine. So even if the code is kept internal to Apple, it will be on a server somewhere. Once data is on a server anywhere, it is vulnerable. That's just a state of the facts. Data is so vulnerable in the cloud that the federal government can't even keep safe the home addresses of CIA employees.
Well, I hate to, I'm now playing devil's advocate because I'm taking a position I don't really believe in or want. But to me, that's a specious argument because a number of servers could be put in a clean room with no connection to the cloud, no connection to anything except the people in that clean room. It could be done that way. Yes. And I agree that the people who then have developed it, well, they would have to be executed. But once they were killed, it would be perfectly secure.
I guess I'm not entirely sure where you're going with the people being killed. But I think your point is that if it's networked, it's not safe. And you can't do this without networking it. You can't even put the computers in a single room. I mean, building an OS for a phone is no small undertaking. It takes a team. It takes several teams that interrelate. You have to test the phone. You have to deploy the operating system to make sure it runs without crashing the phone. All those things will require it being networked. And, you know, the point remains, once you network software, it cannot necessarily be contained, despite anyone's best efforts. And that's ultimately the issue here. I mean, we haven't talked about the legal precedent, which some respects even more disturbing than the technology precedent.
So you've pretty much assured me that if Apple does do what they've been ordered to do, it's not just for that one phone. It's now out in the world that there's a hack, there's a backdoor, whatever you want to call it, that will no longer be secure on the Apple, I guess it was the 5C series.
Close. Now, I think that's close. I would just say that at the moment it's secure because the code does not exist.
Yeah.
No one's written, you know, what the FBI is asking, it's kind of like the Manhattan Project. They want the nuclear code that would unlock any iPhone in someone's physical possession. And at the moment, nobody has that key because Apple's smart enough not to make it. This would create a vulnerability, literally by forcing its creation, and then it's not forcing it to be publicly available, but its creation is enough to run the risk of it getting in the wrong hands.
Now, there's another factor that's implied here, and I'd like to run that by you. We have In the government, and I'm not talking about in the private sector, which is probably a magnitude more than in the government, but we have in the government a division or a department or an organization, whatever you wish to call it, which specializes in cyber security and encryption and all sorts of lovely things that they really shouldn't be bothering with, but it's called the NSA, National Security Agency. You mean that I'm being told, at least by the New York Times, I'm being told that that organization cannot crack into the Apple security. Is that correct?
They at least haven't been public about their capacity to. In some respects, I would be surprised if the NSA lacked that capability. The only word from the NSA on this case has been from the former director, Michael Hayden, who at one point also ran the CIA. And his public comment was that the FBI got it wrong, and that while the FBI is seeking to expand its investigative powers, what Hayden described as seeking a tactical operational advantage with respect to national security, complying with the FBI's demands would impose a strategic loss to national security. So we have a situation here where a national intelligence agency is pursuing a position that would undermine the national security of the United States as recognized by other parts of the intelligence establishment.
To simple things that we can better understand. Hayden is saying, yes, you can accomplish what you want to accomplish, but you realize the unintended consequence will be to make the country less safe.
And everyone else. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the country, every iPhone user, anyone who uses technology, dissidents, journalists.
Well, yeah, you know, if Hayden, who, as you say, used to be CIA and after that was NSA, and now he's in the private sector but doing the same sort of work, if he got so out of joint and he said that, I wonder why, and I don't know whether you know the answer to this, but why is everybody so upset and so knowledgeable about this issue, but everybody pretty much walked away from the Snowden issue?
Yeah, I don't know to what extent there, there certainly is a contrast to be drawn between the two sets of news cycles, and I fear that maybe one of them is that the Snowden disclosures, the revelations of mass surveillance by the National Security Agency violating constitutional norms and statutory limits, that people internalize the Snowden revelations as being only about their own privacy, as opposed to about their own privacy, their own information security, and potential corruption in the intelligence agencies. What the Apple versus FBI controversy, I think, is bringing into much sharper focus is the insecurity that people are threatened with when we lose autonomy over our own devices and our own data. And what this, I think, case is really standing for in the public consciousness is the fusion of privacy and security, because we're not just talking about privacy when we're talking about whether or not someone who lifts your phone out of your bag on the train can then access all of your financial transactions and your health records and your intimate correspondence with your best friends and your intimate partner, the photos you might have exchanged. These are incredibly sensitive things, and losing control over them or having someone else gain access to them is not merely an invasion of privacy, it is a loss of our security. And particularly for people, you know, I don't want to be glib about this, for journalists in authoritarian countries or human rights activists in those countries, for gay people in religiously conservative countries, these are matters of life and death. And the Bureau's position would not just risk the peace of mind of some people, it would put a great many people in harm's, in potentially in harm's way.
We're about to enter a new stage. Hank just told me about it at the top of the show, that our federal government is about to set up or has already set up a legislative committee to look into this whole issue. And it seems to me that every time there's a legislative committee that looks into an issue, I get into trouble as a human being. What is your thoughts and your positions on having a 16 or 18 multi-partisan commission in Congress?
Yeah, the McCall-Warner Commission is one that we are opposed to. Part of the problem relates to the body's composition, which is to say the people on it aren't necessarily renowned for their acuity on these issues. There's a further issue here that relates to relitigating a process that Congress already went through in the 90s when CALEA was passed, that is the Communications Assistance to Law Enforcement Act. This is in the 90s. Congress went through a very searching investigation of precisely these issues, balancing the interests and figuring out whether security was undermined or advanced by encryption. And Congress decided then that companies should not be forced to create new backdoors to give to intelligence agencies. That was a question that Congress considered and declined. And what the FBI is doing in San Bernardino is seeking through the courts powers that Congress has appropriately denied it.
I have one last question for you, because I see we're running out of time, but I do have, and it's the famous Pandora's box question. All right, suppose the government does get the right to crack and have Apple create a backdoor for the iPhone. What's to stop me from throwing away my iPhone, using an Android phone, getting hold of a free application like Telegram, or using PGP from Phil Zimmerman on all my communications?
Right. Nothing is to stop you from doing it. I mean, the idea that this is a security-enhancing demand is speculative at best. You know, I mean, it's worth remembering that the phone in question is the work phone of a person who destroyed their personal phone. So the idea that there's anything on this phone that's going to help in the investigation of an incident where the perpetrators are apparently dead, that escapes me. And it certainly would not prevent people from using other kinds of tools, other devices, other software platforms to achieve the same security from intelligence agencies. This wouldn't actually make us safe. And let's be clear, if mass surveillance worked, we wouldn't be having this problem because the San Bernardino attacks wouldn't have happened, right? Mass surveillance is a tactic. These expansive government powers as tactics, this is not the path to security. Encryption can give us each opportunities to at least keep our data and communications and financial transactions safe from foreign intelligence agencies, from our own intelligence agencies, from criminals, malicious hackers, and whom have you. Last thing I just want to leave your listeners with, we're about to launch a new grassroots network at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's going to be called EFA, the Electronic Frontier Alliance. And it's going to be composed of groups from around the country building the movement for digital rights in their respective communities and on their respective campuses. It's going to be student groups doing teach-ins and documentary screenings. It'll be hacker spaces working on the open source development of software tools and everybody in between. And we're very interested in working with any of your listeners who are currently organizing social groups, social movement groups, whether primarily focused on digital rights or whether that's a secondary issue on your right to, fighting around other struggles like environmental or animal rights, around the movement for black lives or immigrant rights. For all of these communities, information security matters, and we're excited to launch the alliance to defend the electronic frontier.
How would any of our listeners get more information on this, Shahid?
Email us at organizing@eff.org.
That's what started us. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's an order requiring giving courts the opportunity to effectuate powers that they already have, but it's not a statute that confers unlimited power. I mean, writs are just technical terms for documents the courts file to effectuate the law. It doesn't confer vast sweeping powers. I mean, the one way to think of it is in the 250 years. That law has existed, never has it been used this way.
How is it traditionally used? A court gives out a writ being an order, and they have the power to enforce that order. But it doesn't give them the right to create any new orders, only orders that could be given by existing statute.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So like a writ of mandamus, for instance, is a writ that a court might file to require a public official to do something. What the All Writs Act relates to is the capacity of courts to write and enforce those kinds of writs. It's not a source of substantive legal authority in itself. It's
so first
procedural.
Of all, in this case, Hank, underlying the All Writs must be a writ, which there was for the FBI tried to get Apple to do such a thing, and the court said, yes, Apple has to do it. But there has to be a law that allows the court to say Apple has to do this. And has that been adjudicated yet?
That's precisely the issue that's before the court now, right? The order that the San Bernardino court entered was from an ex parte proceeding, which is to say the court just heard from the government behind closed doors and didn't hear all the reasons why, the order was illegal, that it was unconstitutional, that it undermined national security. The judge didn't get to hear any of that. So since the order was entered, Apple has submitted its reply brief. We submitted our amicus brief on behalf of 46 technologists, including the pioneers of encryption. Several other amicus briefs have also gone in to inform the court about further issues that it hasn't yet had an opportunity to consider. We do expect that this order will, meet the fate it deserves and be rescinded, either by the magistrate or, if necessary, on appeal.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard rumors that if either side, the FBI or Apple gets what they want, it will be immediately appealed up to the next level. Do you think this will ever reach the Supreme Court?
I think, quite frankly, not. Only because appeals to get to the Supreme Court take a great deal of time, and people are thinking about the Supreme Court a lot in the current context because of the vacancy and the nomination struggle, but. At the end of the day, for an appeal to reach the Supreme Court, that's at least 3 years. And by that time, it is quite likely the case that Congress will have clarified these issues either by reiterating its prior consensus in 1990 and walling off encryption and ensuring its security for users, or to the extent the FBI has its way, Congress will be writing new powers like the Patriot Act to extend the powers of the intelligence agencies even further. We certainly hope that to the extent Congress considers these issues, that Congress defends the constitutional values at stake rather than the powers of the intelligence agency that seems to have a hard time telling the truth in public. But at the end of the day, what Congress does in particular is very much up to the public, people like your listeners. And I will just draw us back again to that conversation about the alliance to defend the electronic frontier. Congress needs to hear from constituents about these issues, and it needs to hear from constituents not just through petitions and not just on the phone, but in person in groups. And it needs to see op-eds and letters to the editor and a sprawling, vibrant discourse from coast to coast. And thankfully, that's what this controversy is helping beget, is a great deal of attention to these issues, a great deal of discussion around these issues, and hopefully a great deal of learning around these issues. And it's striking when the president gave his recent comments to South by Southwest in Austin, basically revealing a very profound misunderstanding of the issues. You know, math is not something you can negotiate with. And that's ultimately what's at stake here. And, you know, you can try to regulate math, but it's something of a futile exercise. And that's one of the reasons, among others, that we do hope that Congress can keep the intelligence agencies from undermining national security by eroding the encryption that keeps us all safe.
Well, I sadly feel that you're fighting, and it's a good fight, but I think the fight is going to have to go much more than what you're hoping for right now, because I don't think Congress right now is in the mood to accomplish anything of that nature. I just want to...
Well, just realize if Congress does nothing, the FBI doesn't get these powers. I mean, Congress has already decided that the FBI does not have these powers. So
that was a long
the law is clear. And the question now is, does Congress erode that understanding? And that's the threat that the commission proposes.
It's a very subjective statement I'm about to make, but the present Congress has eroded a great deal, including my confidence in it. The folks who are listening, if you didn't remember, EFF.org, if you want to get hold of Sahid Bhattar, Sahid Bhattar, at EFF.org. If you can't...
It's just Shahid at EFF, just my first name. Shahid at EFF.org, or organizing at EFF will reach me.
And if you can't remember that, write to us, and we will certainly forward it to him. I want to thank you very much for spending this few minutes with us, and if anybody is totally confused by it, we'll get you back on to explain it again, because this is vitally, vitally important, much more important than anything we have discussed this year, and we discuss all sorts of really great things.
Public service announcements. The Westchester PC Users Group will be having a presentation on Microsoft's new HoloLens. January 5th, meeting time is 7 p.m. Keller Williams Realty is where they meet. Location, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on social media round robin Friday, January 6th, 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting on Tuesday, January 10th at 7:15 p.m., and they will be meeting at the Rasa Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. New York Amateur Computer Club. There will be a presentation on printer technology in 2017. Thursday, January 12th at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. Photo ID is required. Product Testing 101. I've been product testing for many years. My methodology differs from how other organizations evaluate product offerings. I find it interesting that almost all product testing results in some empirical testing score. It is if you can evaluate and score a product by the numbers. I always refer to initial review of the product as a first look. You can easily match up function to functions, measurement to measurement, but a complete product test needs to include usability of the product. These factors should include navigation, learning curve, durability, and ease of understanding. Some examples. Let's look at the total computational power of a CPU. If the total computational power of a dual-core CPU equals the total computational power of a quad-core CPU, which is better? There's no clear answer. It is a function of what you intend to use the CPU for. If you're doing heavy editing, the single-thread compute path of the dual-core CPU with an equivalent quad-core CPU will be faster than the single-thread on that quad-core. But if you have many I/O-bound tasks, the quad-core would be more efficient. Another example. The most popular Office product, of course, is Microsoft Office. They are constantly upgrading the product with new functions and new documentation formats. Ask yourself if the new functions will ever be used. If not, what is it that makes Microsoft Office new release new and improved? Nothing from a consumer point of view, but from a Microsoft revenue point of view, it is an organic product where the messaging is, you need it. Now, if you really need a free copy or want to have a free copy of Office, open source supporters will tell you to consider OpenOffice or LibreOffice. These are very fine, fully functional Office products. But if you've been weaned on Microsoft Office or need to coexist with others using Microsoft Office, they function very similarly, but the difference in navigation makes it difficult as you have to transpose usability on the fly. You may want to consider the installation of Kingsoft Office free. It is far from a perfect clone of Microsoft Office, but for the average person, the available functions are a strong subset clone of Microsoft Office. Due to the ever-escalating cost in cable channel subscriptions, many have or are considering just using a digital antenna for over-the-air broadcast channels. In the testing of indoor antennas, there are two ways of testing. The most practical methodology is to mount the antenna in the preferred position and then determine what channels are available. The other is to test with different placement orientation of the antenna to determine what channels are available. In each case, mark down what channels are received, language of the channel, and the content of the channel. If you cannot understand the language of the channel, its availability adds nothing to the value of it. If the content of channel is not something you would be using at all, that also adds nothing of value. And if you're not apt to constantly reorient the antenna, then the actual usable channels is far less than advertised. When it comes to review of a software application, there are three basic functions I look for. The software apps have to have the means to import data, export data, and the mobility of the software application database to be moved or used in another application. Lacking the means to do this with any application package locks you into an area of non-support if the vendor is no longer in business. This is becoming more important now that many applications are cloud-based. You may want to use the application in offline mode, and when the cloud service is out or you are not within the reception distance, it's of no value. So why all this fuss about product testing? Simple. Don't just go by numbers alone. Apple's new MacBook Pro is the first to miss out on Consumer Reports' recommendation. Apple's latest launch of MacBook Pro laptops has failed to achieve recommended ratings from Consumer Reports for the first time in the product's history. A substandard battery life performance was the key reason for the U.S. tech giant to miss out on the recommendation from Consumer Reports after extensive testing on three of Apple's new MacBook Pro models. Apple says its latest MacBook Pro laptop's battery life should operate for up to 10 hours, yet Consumer Reports discovered the three models tested would range from less than 4 hours to more than 18 hours. A laptop's battery life may vary from one trial to another by less than 5%, Consumer says. A laptop's battery life may vary from one trial to another by less than 5%, Consumer Reports said in a blog post published Thursday. However, the widely disparate figures we found in the MacBook Pro test an average wouldn't reflect anything a consumer would be likely to experience in the real world. Battery life is an important attribute for a laptop, and it represents a significant portion of our overall score. After factoring together our complete test results, consumer reports find that all three MacBook Pro laptops failed to meet their standards for recommended models. Apple is working with Consumer Reports to figure out why the review site's battery test results for the new MacBook Pro do not match the gadget's giant lab tests and field data. Consumer Reports published a surprise report saying it could not recommend any new MacBook Pro model due to its erratic, if not bad, battery life. The MacBook Pro battery life results were highly inconsistent from one trial to the next, Consumer Reports said. This is the first time a MacBook hasn't received a recommended designation from Consumer Reports. Apple Senior Vice President Phil Schiller followed up with a tweet saying that Apple is working with CR to understand their battery test and results do not match their own lab test and field data. Schiller linked to a story from iMore that says Consumer Report was just going for a pre-Christmas headline and should have done more testing. CR Review says that in-house testing revealed wild fluctuations in battery life for unplugged MacBook Pro computers. In the case of the 13-inch model without a touch bar, for example, battery life ranged from 19.5 hours to just 4.5 hours. Apple says the devices should operate for up to 10 hours between charges. Laptops did very well in measures of display quality and performance, but in terms of battery life, we found that the models varied dramatically from one trial to another. Consumer Reports said in a blog that the MacBook Pro rating, it ended up giving the 15-inch MacBook Pro a rating of 56 points out of 100, and the 13-inch version with or without a touch bar got 40 and 47 respectively out of 100. For the battery test, they downloaded a series of 10 web pages sequentially, starting with the battery fully charged and ending when the laptop shuts down. The Consumer Reports post read, "The web pages are stored on a server in our lab and transmitted over a Wi-Fi network set up specifically for this purpose. We conducted our battery tests using the computer's default browser, Safari, in the case of the MacBook Pro laptops." That's not the way you test it. Because why use Wi-Fi? You're not going to get the same number of transmissions because of the wireless nature of transmission. Why didn't they just do a straight series of copies from one media to another over and over again until the battery ran down? Well, I guess if you go by the numbers, that's what you get. You go by the numbers. Caveat emptor, Alibaba. The United States Trade Representative, USTR, has put Alibaba's Taobao auction site on the notorious markets list as haven for counterfeit goods. The USTR cites the Chinese internet giant's online auction site that regularly deals in counterfeit goods. Taobao, which is the world's largest online shopping destination by gross merchandise volume, has made some efforts to shut down fake goods sellers, but it's not enough, according to the trade ambassador, Michael Froman. Being on the list doesn't do you any favors, but there are also no direct sanctions either. It's more of a naming and shaming type of a deal. The marketplaces, tactics, and schemes that undermines and threatens America's creative industries changes quickly and requires our constant attention, Froman said. This notorious markets list illustrates a serious of copyright piracy and trademark counterfeiting in online marketplaces. The 2016 list underscores the need for accountable governments everywhere to take on these forms of piracy and counterfeiting at every stage of the global supply chain to prevent final products that put health and safety of end consumers at risk. Froman noted that the website has very poor mechanisms for reporting copyright infringement and intellectual property theft. Rights holders had real problems getting takedown notices enacted, and complaint pages were often not available in English, and the services had many broken links and discontinued email addresses that makes getting in touch with the company very difficult. In an open letter, Alibaba president Michael Evans said he was very disappointed with the decision. His business has made strenuous efforts to get rid of counterfeit goods from Taobao, including more than doubling its fake product takedown in last year, he claimed. Our results speak for themselves. Unfortunately, the USTR decision leads us to a question, whether the USTR acted based on actual facts or was influenced by current political climate, Evans said, referring to U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's saber-rattling with China. Nevertheless, the decision sends the wrong message and is inconsistent with the effective collaborative approach we have taken with brands and governments around the world and our fight against counterfeiting. Evans pointed out that more than 100,000 brands are happy to do business on his platform and that anti-knockoff operations are always being improved and expanded. He added that these efforts have only expanded since the USTR took Taobao off its list 4 years ago and would continue in the future. My own take on it is, I would not invest in Alibaba and I would shy away from that website. Do you have spare time? Perhaps you have time to play with what I call Tiny Computer Nation. Here is what has been announced. Your old machine may no longer run Windows efficiently. When your old laptop takes 5 minutes to boot Windows, you may start to think about giving it away or worse, just tossing it out. Before you toss the old tired notebook into the dumpster, a company called Neverware has a better idea. Why not convert it to run Google Chrome OS? Using the company's free cloud-ready software, you can convert it into a dual boot system that runs both Chrome and Windows. Chrome OS is not demanding of resources at all. In fact, your old machine may be more powerful than many new Chromebooks. That means it runs all of Google apps and be peppy enough to browse the internet, work on WordPress, or do other word-based chores. Neverware, the company, is also offering its cloud-ready software to schools at $59 a seat. Educators are thrilled to save money and reuse perfectly good laptops, given these tight budgets. However, the move threatens traditional educational resellers, most notably Apple and Microsoft. Google, however, is fine with it, but would rather you didn't call the converted machine Chromebooks. Not every machine will work, but most will with dual boot, will only work with pre-existing Windows 7, 8, 8.1, or 10 build, which is installed with UEFI mode, according to Neverware. That means older legacy BIOS Windows systems won't work. But machines less than 10 years old should meet these requirements. If you got an old laptop or desktop lying around, hey, give it a whirl. You might have some fun during the holidays. Raspberry Pi releases an OS to breathe new life into old PCs. The lightweight Debian-based OS can boot and run from a USB stick. The Raspberry Pi Foundation has released an experimental version of its Linux-based Pixel OS for Windows and Mac PCs. The OS, originally designed to run only on the Raspberry Pi hobby board, comes with a Chromium web browser and a suite of productivity and coding tools. We asked ourselves one simple question. If we like Pixel so much, why ask people to buy the hardware, Raspberry Pi, in order to run it? Built on top of Debian, the OS is light enough to run most old machines, provided you have at least 512 megabytes of RAM. It's easy to try out, but they urge you to back up the machine that you're running on before you do it. After downloading the image, you burn it either to a DVD or a USB stick. In all likelihood, you're talking about a USB stick, and then enable booting of those devices. You can normally do that by tweaking your PC BIOS or by holding the C key down when you boot up a Mac. From there, it'll run the OS with no need to install anything. If you boot it on a USB stick, you'll get the option to run with persistence, meaning that any changes or files will stick for the next session. If you rather just play around and start fresh next time, you can run without persistence or reset it. As mentioned, you get a full suite of apps and a browser, but unlike the Pi version, there's no Minecraft or Wolfram Mathematica because of licensing issues. As mentioned, the Pixel OS is still in the experimental stages, and it doesn't run on all machines. They'll be releasing more updates going forward, but if you're interested in trying now, hey, give it a try. You'll have some fun. I asked Marty Winston to comment on trends in consumer electronics that have succeeded to push through in 2016.
You know, they say, should old acquaintance be forgot, it may be early Alzheimer's. So before I forget what I found noteworthy in the tech of 2016, let's jump into that. Is it the year in review? More like the rear in your view. 2016 may not have marked the very first emergence of these things, but here in Capsule are my picks among the trends that more strongly manifested themselves this year. More capable drones, more available internet bandwidth, remarkable energy and longevity advancements in home comfort systems, better automation for protection against damage from water leaks, major advancements in LiDAR technology and accessibility, the strongest downward pressures to date on LED lighting costs, major performance improvements in small, low-priced computers, lower prices and higher performance for video surveillance cameras. So okay, let's go through those. I said more capable drones. It's in the navigation. It's in their ability to detect and avoid obstacles, and it's in their accuracy in taking off, landing, and avoiding trouble. Also, pricing, even with very good 4K cameras, is now below $1,000. It's accessible. If you wanted to check your gutters or the other practical purposes, more power to you. More available internet bandwidth, mostly because of the build-out of fiber-to-the-wall connections. And you'll find these in many places. And if your service isn't talking to you about it, ask. Just ask. Remarkable energy and longevity in advancements in home comfort systems. These are variable controls on compressors and blowers and the other elements of HVAC systems. Because they're going to variable controls, not simply on and off, these things are now able to last decades longer than before. It uses less energy. Everything's good about it. Check it out. Better automation for protection against damage from water leaks. Thanks to a sensor called the water rope, anywhere on its length gets wet, any very simple interface circuit can signal it's a water leak. And you can run it, for example, down the wall around the base of your washer or water heater, and bang, you know whether there's a water leak there. That popped up as better than two little buttons on the floor in the last year. LiDAR technology dropped to $125 and is dropping to $100 for a single line, class one, which means it's not going to blind you if you're not looking directly at it. LiDAR and accessibility is improving. 2017, even bigger. LED lighting, really, the cost drop there is due to improvements in individual emitter efficiency and the ability to deliver ribbons of emitters, these long lengths of things that can be shaped into fixtures, fixtures with 60 to 100,000 hour life expectancy. Major performance improvements in small, low-priced computers. We've seen it in the Raspberry Pi Model 3B, which is a very respectable little $36 computer. The Arduino Primo is due out shortly, and it's trying to be more the same at its own level. This is a level of computing that we really didn't have 20 years ago, and we can now buy for chump change. I'm loving it. Lower prices and higher performance for video surveillance cameras. Very good, very well-qualified cameras, $100 to $150 retail price. Yeah, there are cameras that do more cost more. There are cameras that do less and cost less. But that's about a third of what the center point on pricing used to be. Meanwhile, there's an established category that is rapidly fading as millennials abandon the office at home. Historically, as communications improve, it allows more flexibility in where work happens. This led to an era when working at home became commonplace. The technology for that tended to anchor in desktop or laptop computers, which made the home office a commonly created space in the home. Millennials are now a force behind changing that from a dedicated space to working in non-dedicated spaces, from sofas to easy chairs to beds. Credit better tablets and improved Wi-Fi for some of the shift. This means a dedicated home office space for them is now reduced to whatever area it takes to plug in a router and maybe, but not often, a printer. As this population segment ages, it signals a change in the fortunes of many home office furniture and technology products, much as we saw a decline in the purchases of fake theater seating when the home theater market faded. If you're going to CES, in a week or two, many product announcements, so many it's like a tsunami. Consider this as a new strip among your litmus tests of product announcements. Politically, 2016 may have been a year of major changes, but in terms of technology, it was more like watching bread mold grow until the whole slice turns green. For the most part, smartphones and tablets made more headlines for the few that could catch fire than for truly remarkable new features. AR and VR got a lot of hype, but something tells us that a lot of the sales in Europe and Asia are so people in crowded homes can watch dirty movies in private. More cars have cameras and warning systems, but those aren't entirely new. Computers aren't really doing much more than before. No one has found a cure for the time vampires of social media. Worse, they're proving themselves to be enemies of reporting, of education, of political freedom, and to a great extent, of free will. So what's positive about 2016? Well, lots of things. Well, not so much politics, not so much tech, not so much common sense, but we are seeing that as a species, we still survive, still endure, still cling to hope, and still make great choices in our radio listening. Marty Winston at the News Tips Bulletin saying, Happy New Year.
This year, we're ending with 2016. It's a leap year. We've had a leap day. Did you know that we also have a leap second? Well, according to the National Physical Laboratory, this year they will insert a leap second just before midnight in order to keep the time scale based on atomic clocks in sync with the time based on Earth's rotation. Atomic clocks are more than a million times better than keeping time than rotation of the Earth, which fluctuates unpredictably. Leap seconds are needed to prevent civil time from drifting away from Earth time. Although the drift time is small, taking around 1,000 years to accumulate 1 hour, if not corrected, it will eventually result in clocks showing midday before sunrise. Leap seconds are added on June 30th and December 31st, with this year being the 27th leap second since the practice began in 1971. They typically occur every 2 or 3 years, with the last one inserted in June 2015. Happy leap second! The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. We wish everyone a very happy new year. Stay safe, stay warm. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.